What I had in mind was to talk about three questions. What is religion? Why should we be interested in it? And how should we teach it, if that's what we're doing? So maybe I'll say a little about those three questions.
Yes.
The difficulty with answering the question, what is religion? Well, obviously it depends very much on the position of the person answering the question. And there are a lot of definitions, or apparent definitions, which are really no more a kind of tactical move to persuade. Marx's formulation, religion is the opium of the people. Well, that's obviously coming from a very particular point of view. Some people would share that point of view, but a lot of other people wouldn't. So it's not terribly useful as a definition, or as a kind of model of religion. So it's good for starting arguments, but not a very helpful model. So what I think we need is a kind of short definition or model of religion that is acceptable to everyone, believers or atheists or agnostics or skeptics or whatever. So thinking about that problem, it seems to me that what it is fundamentally is an understanding of reality. It's a kind of account of what is real and what the world is all about, what the universe is about, what we're about, why we're here, our position in the wider scheme of things. And it's an attempt to deal with questions which have no easy answer. In this respect, it's quite different from various other intellectual and cultural pursuits, because the kinds of questions that religion deals with are really intractable. There's not an easy answer, and there's not a final answer. Obviously, one of the sort of big problems that religion deals with is mortality. Something we're all going to face. We're all going to die. I mean, we know that. And questions about, you know, whether we have a post-mortem destiny, whether something happens to us after death, or whether we just disappear into the dust. Or, properly speaking, I think our religion is an attempt to explain the whole of reality, not just some particular domain, but the whole of reality. But it's also a way of living. So it gives us an understanding of things, but also shows us how to live in the light of that understanding. So one of the problems in the modern world is that religion is thought of by an awful lot of people as just another form of ideology. In other words, it's just a kind of cultural construct. It's just something that people have dreamt up over time and in their different ways, and it may have been more or less useful at this time, you know, or that time ago. But it's something that can be jettisoned now because we've got better ways of understanding it, you know, in particular modern science. But of course the thing that distinguishes religions, all religions, Eastern, Western, primordial, indigenous, whatever, the one thing they all have in common that distinguishes them from ideologies is that they all insist that there is a supra-mundane reality, there's some kind of reality that's not bound by time and space. Everything else is. Everything that's, you know, accessible to our senses and that we experience in the kind of everyday world, it comes and goes. But all religions say there is a greater reality beyond that. Now, of course, the word we usually use for that is God, but there are many different words, and Buddhism in particular doesn't like using that word and doesn't like that approach to things, so it's a non-theistic religion, which is quite a different matter from being atheistic. It's not atheistic, it's non-theistic. So, from a religious point of view, not from a sort of sceptical point of view, but from a religious point of view, it just won't do to say that religion is just another ideology, because it affirms this other reality. And it claims that there is some exchange, some interaction between, let's use the word God for the moment, between God and us. And that God, in various ways, has made himself, if we want to call him a him, has made himself known to us, and that we're in relationship with him. So this is a distinctive thing about religion. Now, looking at it just from a sort of more descriptive point of view, we say, well, what are the things that we need to constitute a religion? Well, I've already given you one, which is the belief in a greater reality, a transcendent reality. We also need a method. We could call the account of reality doctrine, and we could call everything else method. So that's a very simple kind of notion of religion. Doctrine, method. An account of reality, a way of living in the light of that understanding of that doctrine. But if we want to elaborate the model a little bit more and look at doctrine, break it down a bit, if we say doctrine's about the way we understand things, the way we conceptualise, the way we take things to be, then we could say in all religions what we have are myths, that is to say stories. And of course I don't mean myth in the modern sense where people use it just to mean something that's not true. I mean it in a much more positive, poetic, symbolic sense. You know, just to give an example, the myth that we get in the book of Genesis in the Bible. Now, from a sort of historical, scientific point of view, we might say, well, not entirely satisfactory. We know the world wasn't created in 6 days and so on and so on. But of course, that story enshrines truths that are infinitely more interesting than anything a kind of purely scientific approach or a purely historical approach can tell us. So myths are not to be looked at in that kind of literal-minded either-or way. They're much more in the way we look at a painting. So, I mean, when we go look at Rembrandt or someone in the National Gallery, we don't say, is this true or false? We say, if we say anything at all, we say, well, does this mean anything to me? Does it do something for me? Does it broaden my horizons? Does it enrich my understanding? Does it make for a fuller experience? So myths are like that. And all religions have got myths. And actually, if you start investigating them and looking into them, you see that myths always have three levels. They have a metaphysical level. So they're telling us about what? They're telling us something about that greater reality, which of course can be conceived in many different ways. They're cosmological, so they tell us about the universe. They tell us something about the cosmos and why things are organised the way they are. You know, why the heavenly bodies move in the way they do, for example. Plato's answer to that question is very interesting. He says, why do the heavenly bodies move the way they do? Why are they organised the way they are? And his answer, I like very much, so that we may philosophise. Anyway, metaphysical, cosmological, anthropological, that is to say, to do with the human condition. So we've got myths as part of the sort of understanding of reality. In most religion, we've got doctrines or dogmas which are formulated in one way or another, in creeds, in books, and so on. And we've got values, so that the religion says, you know, these things are good, these things are not so good. This is what you, this is the way you want to live your life. These are the sorts of things you ought to hold dear. And those values are kind of crystallised in moral codes, the appropriate way to behave and so on. Now, part of the problem in the modern world is that religion, for a lot of people, has become completely associated with codes. They just think it's morality, or more strictly speaking, they think it's moralism. In other words, you can't blame them sometimes, given the experiences they've had, but their understanding of religion is that it's just a bunch of rules, most of which they don't know about. So, they've got a very negative experience and a very negative understanding of religion. Now, of course, moral codes are important, no doubt, but they're actually just one part of something much bigger. So what have we got? We've got myths, we've got doctrines, we've got values which crystallise in codes. We've got rituals. All religions. You can't have a religion without rituals. So, what's a ritual in brief? Well, it's a prescribed activity that's repeated over and over through time, passed down through generations, done in a particular way. We don't improvise, we don't just make up rituals, we don't get out of the bath in the morning and think, oh, I'm going to make up a new ritual today. We do it the way it's always been done, the way it's laid down in tradition. And of course, there are different sorts of rituals, but many of them involve physical activity, gestures of one sort and another, the Muslims at prayer, for example, all rich with symbolic meaning and significance. We have to have some institutions because there's no such thing as a one-person religion. You've got to have lots of people, you've got to have a significant number of people, and once you have that, well, you've got to start agreeing on, when things are going to happen, who's going to make decisions, where we're going to get money for the new building, the mosque or the synagogue or whatever it happens to be. So you need some way of getting people organised and, means of making decisions and all that sort of thing. And lastly, I've mentioned one which people often overlook, but which when you think about it is true, an indispensable element of religion is art. There's no religion anywhere without art. It is integral. Why is this? Well, there are lots of reasons, and Spike could probably give us a whole catalogue of them, but I think the most obvious reason is that art communicates in a way which words don't and concepts don't, because it addresses the whole person. An illiterate medieval peasant can go into Chartres Cathedral and look at the stained glass window and it'll mean something to him or her. Give him Aquinas, well, he can't even begin to read it. He's got no idea what it's about. Try and explain, Aristotelian philosophy, you're not going to get anywhere. That sort of discourse is only for, I hesitate to use the word, but an elite. Art's for everybody, no matter what their intellectual endowment, no matter what their educational level, and no matter what their age. We don't say, well, you can't look at the stained glass window in the cathedral until you're 16 or 18. When you come of age, you can have a look. No, it's there, it's in front of you. It addresses the whole person, the imagination, the feelings, all of our experiences. So art's a tremendously potent and important part of any religion, I think. And one of the tragedies of Protestantism in England, at least for a period in certain places, was that they went in for this absurd vandalism of destroying all the works of art. And Cromwell and Cunningham, shocking, terrible business. So, now I've sort of answered my first question, what is religion? We could say a lot more, but that'll do for the moment. Why should we study it? Why should we go? That's so obvious, I have to go into it. I mean, it's obviously shaped human history in all sorts of ways. It's shaped human culture, pervaded human culture. Our culture is saturated with it, even though many people today have got no interest in religion and they might be just apathetic, most of them, a lot of them are indifferent, some are hostile. But there's no escaping the kind of legacy of religion and its place in the culture. You only have to arrive in London and start walking around. Every corner you turn around, there's a cathedral, a church, a chapel, or go into the National Gallery and, you know, these magnificent paintings from all these centuries of Madonnas and apostles and Christ figures and so on. But perhaps even more important than all of that is the fact that the vast majority of the people in the world today, even in these times, are still religious. You know, in Western Europe and the Anglophone world, we're not very religious on the whole. But in many other parts of the world, people are still very religious, sometimes intensely religious and sometimes intensely religious in perhaps not very happy ways. So religion is whatever one personally thinks, whatever one's personal position is. Regardless of that, the fact is that religions are tremendously important, profound force in the world today. So whether we think it's a good thing or a bad thing, it would certainly be a good thing to try and understand it. What's going on here? Why are these people behaving in this way? Why do they think that way? And so on. So to get to the last question, what's the best way to study religion? Well, if you look at it, if you look at the books about religion, if you look at religion courses in schools and universities or in seminaries or various other places, I think you can see that there are four basic approaches to the study of religion. So one is what I would call a faith-based approach. So this is the sort of thing that would be taught, for example, in Catholic schools. We're looking at religion from a Christian point of view and indeed from a Catholic point of view, and we're understanding things through that kind of lens, through that kind of filter, and what we want to do is inculcate, you know, the doctrines, the myths, the values and so on. We want to inculcate those in the students. So what we're really doing is offering a kind of religious training, a religious education, properly speaking. So that's one kind of form of religious education. Now, to go to the other extreme, there's what we could call the sceptical, or the people who take this approach usually use the word rational, which is sort of sounds a bit more positive. But for my own part, I use the word sceptical to describe those people, because their starting point, the starting point in a faith-based or kind of theological approach is obviously this is all true, that God has spoken to us, he's revealed his word, and so on and so forth, and we've got the goods, we've got the answers here, and this is how things are. The rational, sceptical approach is based on the notion that we all agree that religion is mumbo-jumbo and superstition and has got things wrong, but we still think it's worth studying because it's influenced a lot of people, and our job is to work out how and why people could believe such things. So, you know, to use Marx again, it's just one kind of interpretation, but it will serve our purpose here. You know, Marx says religion is a kind of instrument of class oppression that's used by the dominant class to divert the attention of the proletariat, as he called it, the urban working class, away from their material condition and to confuse them and to offer them consolation so that, you know, instead of saying, well, we're oppressed and exploited and we ought to be doing something about it, they say to themselves, or the religious leaders say to them, it's okay because whatever happens down here, it'll be okay because in the next life you'll be rewarded. Just live a good life here, and you know, if you're being oppressed and exploited, don't worry about that. You'll get your just desserts in the end, and so will they. So for Marx, religion's just a kind of, you know, a political instrument. You know, for Freud, well, you know, religion's just basically a refusal to grow up. It's the product of kind of neuroses that we develop as children, and we want to believe that there's someone in charge, and we want to believe that it all makes sense. And we're not courageous enough to face the facts and face the real situation, so we console ourselves with these fantasies about heaven, angels, afterlife, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, Marx and Freud are two pretty extreme examples, but nonetheless, a lot of people who are involved in teaching religion as an academic discipline, and they're the people I've come most into contact with, well, a lot of them are atheists. They're not pretending to be anything else. So what they imagine themselves to be doing is studying religion, just like we study sociology or psychology or anything else. We're just studying religion from a kind of detached, objective, academic viewpoint, and we're trying to analyse it, we're trying to sort of pick it to pieces and understand how such a thing could happen. So that's a second approach, quite different from the first, obviously. Both of those approaches, in my view, from my perspective, are quite unsatisfactory. If we're talking about religious studies in an educational, a sort of broad educational context, I've got absolutely no problem with, you know, let's say Jewish people in a Jewish school teaching Judaic law and all that. I've got no problem with that at all. In fact, I'm all for it. But if we're talking about a much more general situation where we're dealing with all sorts of different people, well, then obviously that faith-based approach isn't altogether satisfactory. So the other two approaches are more interesting, I think, more potentially more profitable. And one of them I would call the phenomenological approach, and this is one that was made best known by Machia. I don't know if I still talk about Eliade, if you've come across anything.
Yeah, he's been Spanish.
Yeah, he's gone out of vogue. He's in vogue hat now, as far as most people are concerned. I still think he's got a lot to offer. So Eliade's approach basically is, look, we don't want to get caught up on questions of whether things are true or false. You know, as soon as you start thinking and discussing and arguing about, you know, is Christian teaching true or is Hindu teaching true, well, there's no end to dissension and squabble and carry on, because people will have their different points of view. So let's not ask, you know, is the account of the universe given in the Vedas true or not? Is it accurate or not? Is it helpful? Let's not ask that. Let's ask the question, what do the Vedas mean to a Hindu? How does a Hindu understand all of this? It could be anything, whatever. Or, you know, why are they going down to the river in the morning? We're not there to decide whether going down to the river in the morning is a good thing or a bad thing, or a wise thing or a foolish thing. That's not our job. Our job is to understand why these people are doing this and what they think is happening. So we're going to leave aside the question of whether it's true or false or whatever, if that question applies. So what we're doing is studying the phenomenon. That's what it's called, phenomenological. It's also got a bit of philosophy to do with, you know, Husserl and all those people. We won't go into all that. And then lastly, there's what I call the universalist approach. The theological approach, the faith-based approach, is based on the notion that one faith is true and at least, in some sense, better than the others. Not that the others are necessarily wrong, but that this one's the best. The rationalist approach is based on the notion that they're all wrong. Okay, so the theological, one's right and the others are, they might be more or less okay, or they might be really bad, depending on what your position is. If you're a sort of rabid you know, fundamentalist evangelical, or their attitude to other religions is probably not going to be very sympathetic. You're probably going to say, well, they're all bad and wrong and so on. But if you're a more open-minded, liberal kind of person, then you might have a rather more charitable attitude to these other religions. But anyway, one's right and all the rest of it more or less wrong, or they're all wrong, or the third approach, phenomenological question, issue approach, well, we're not interested in whether they're right or wrong, all we're interested in is what they mean to the believers. The universalist approach, they're all right. They've all got something, they've all got some access to the truth, they've all got some profound understanding enshrined in them, and so they're all of value. And of course the people who most of my work's been concerned with are that they're known by various names, traditionalists, perennialists, Gamonians, whatever. So this approach takes it that all religions are issued from the same source, they all come from God, lots of different images are used, but one that's often used is that they're like paths up a mountain. So, you know, you've got a mountain there, well, how many paths up it are there? Well, any number, countless number. You can approach from over here, this way is very steep and difficult, this way is a bit easier, you know, over there you get a good view out that way. Each one's different, but you're all climbing the same mountain, and the further you go, the further you climb, the closer you get to the top, and when you get to the top, you're in the same place as all the other people who got to the top. Or another image that's used, it's really the same image, just in two dimensions, is the circle and the centre. So the religions are like situated on the circumference. The truth, or God, or the divine, or reality, various words you can use, is the centre. And the radii coming from the circumference into the centre are like paths towards the truth. Okay, so they're all these different religions, you know, Buddhism here, Christianity, Judaism, Islam and so on. They're all oriented around this centre, and the more deeply we go into them and the more we understand the message, closer we're getting to the centre. And when we arrive at the centre, it's not a Buddhist centre or a Christian centre, it's the centre. In other words, ultimately, not right now, but ultimately, if we go the whole journey, well then there's no such thing as Christian truth or Buddhist truth or Jewish truth or Aboriginal truth, there's just truth. We've all arrived at the same point. But that, of course, is the sort of, most of us don't get to that stage, at least not in this lifetime.